Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. And you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where we think the world is going. And we talk about the future. And we're not afraid to take a pretty unusual view of those matters. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're not paying attention. We believe, and as I've demonstrated here over the past couple of days, that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. And we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, man, I'm doing great. Doing real good. If I don't get hit by falling debris, that is, I may be in the debris field of this of these satellites that are raining down junk all over Texas and now Louisiana. Just got word a couple hours ago.
Are these the two satellites that collided?
Yes. And apparently they're coming down in this area. So wish me well.
Try not to get hit, but I mean, if you can get a picture or something, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, if I could, if it landed close enough to where I could go out and get a picture, that would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, above all, don't get hit. But I mean, if you can get some debris or something like that, I just, you know, I think that would be pretty memorable. So just throwing that out there. This is the first time ever in history that two artificial satellites have collided.
That's right.
Just goes to show you how crowded the low orbital area over the Earth is. Actually, it's probably not really crowded at all in the sense we would think. I mean, there's lots of space up there, but probably you're looking at some very tight bands around where it's optimal to put these satellites. And I guess they got these two just too close to each other.
Flight control tries to keep track of every piece of debris that's up there, and can you imagine how much harder their job is now? You know, I mean,
now it's just a mess up there, right? I mean, it probably was anyway, but it's got to be a huge mess now.
Yeah. They're probably glad some of it's raining down.
Yeah, well, keep an eye out for it. And, again, I think, you know, there might be an eBay thing you could do with some of that stuff, too. So I'm just going to probably pick up a couple extra bucks as well as, you know, have some good blogging that you could do on that. We've got our chat host, Michael Darling, on the phone with us. Are you Michael?
I'm good. And, you know, thinking of eBay, I'm not sure how you'd verify any of that stuff came from what you claim it's from. So I'm thinking just grab something out of your garage and claim it's part of that satellite.
I got a lot of, like, electronic parts and pieces and stuff like that. Yeah, I could. What you want to do is maybe take an arc welder to it and kind of fuse it a little bit, right? You know, so
go burn it out back and then put it on eBay.
Yeah.
I bought, you know, real beverages for a large group of people at a bar in England, claiming to, you know, acquire a piece of the actual Berlin Wall. It was a little piece of concrete with some paint on it. What do I know?
you bought them drinks, or they bought you drinks?
In order to get the little piece of concrete, I bought drinks.
Oh, I see. Now you have the little piece of the Berlin Wall.
As far as I know, it was some guy's driveway from Cambridge.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe you can compare it to my pieces that I actually chipped off the wall and see if they match.
That should be a fun thing. Do a wall coming down reunion and bring everybody who thinks they have a piece of the wall back there and rebuild it.
Piece by piece.
Well, you know, when I moved out of my old house, the front steps of that place were just crumbling. And I was kind of having to have them worked on. Who knew I had a little income source there that I was just constantly throwing away all the potential pieces from the, you know, Berlin Wall. But hey, we were do anything dishonest like that. That's not what we're about. Stephen brings up back an electronic component and says it was part of a satellite that re-entered the atmosphere. You can bet your bottom dollar that that's exactly what it was. So. We are now going to bring out our very special surprise guest. We welcome back once again to Fast Forward Radio our good friend, the Director of Research for the Lifeboat Foundation, Brian Wong. Brian, how are you?
I'm very good. Great to be here.
Welcome back to Fast Forward Radio. It's great to have you back. And I think you're closing in now on the PJ versus Brian sweepstakes to see who's the most frequent guest on the show. What do you think, Stephen? Is Brian tied now? Has he moved into first place? What are we looking at here?
I think PJ is still edging him out. You're going to have to come be on the show a couple more times, Brian, and then you'll be in PJ territory, and that'll be cool.
Yeah, cause I think she was on a few times in between, so she's still coming up and pushing that record higher. So.
That's right. We have her on as often as we can, and we have you on as often as we can. I think y'all are just going to be neck and neck for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's important that you both keep coming back, you know, to stay in the competition. We want you to stay viable. That's the important
thing,
Brian. So, got to keep coming back so you stay viable. Well, we asked Brian to join us because we were planning to talk about speculonomics this evening, talk about economics from a speculative standpoint. And this kind of follows from the discussions that we had over the last 2 weeks. We talked about the end of scarcity, and we talked about arriving somehow, and we talked about what those different ways of getting there might be, but arriving somehow into a world of abundance, a world where scarcity no longer exists. And we got through that last week, and I felt that we had really talked it through pretty well. And then this week, for whatever reason, every news story that really caught my attention and everything that seemed like a good topic for Fast Forward coming up this week seemed to fall right back into the same set of issues. And it just seemed like, okay, well, we're on a roll here. We're gonna keep going with the roll. We're gonna talk about speculonomics this evening. And one of the things that I saw that really caught my attention, Brian, was this piece that you had done. I think this was a while back, maybe a week or more back, on the world achieving a local middle class standard. Can you kind of tell us what that's all about?
Okay, back out for a bit, but I think I know what you're talking about there. So basically, half the world's population has achieved a local middle class standard, and they define that as there's several definitions, but one is that one third of your income goes to non-essentials, so not food, not housing, not scraping by, not living hand to mouth. So yeah, one third of your income can go to whatever you want to spend it upon. Some of the ways to define it is like $2 to $13 per day. So depending on how you define it, about half the world's population has achieved that. So basically gotten out of hand to mouth existence up to having a little bit of spending money. And depending upon where you live and, how much things cost there, that could vary how much you can afford to buy. And then there was another related piece, a couple of related pieces, where there's 4 million mobile connections that exist now. So of those half the world that are kind of beyond hand to mouth, pretty much all of them have mobile phones. So it's just an interesting shift that we're getting away from this third world poverty thing into mass middle classdom.
So let's look at that 4 billion mobile phone connections. How many people live in the world today? What's the current estimated world population?
So it's 6.7 billion, I think. 6.7?
Yeah.
6.6 billion?
That sounds
billion.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So that means somewhere in the vicinity of 2.5 billion people have mobile phones, but everybody else does? Is that how we read that statistic?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. There's 100 million like broadband mobile connections or rest of the mobile connections. So there's a slight takeoff from that in terms of not mobile phones. And you may have some people who have doubled up, you know, the guy who has his BlackBerry and something else. But pretty much you have 4 billion mobile phone connections, pretty much half. Again, a little over half the world should have it. And, And the thing is, they got there, like, moved up from 3 billion to 4 billion I think, took less than a year. It was like second quarter 2008 where they had $3 billion. So the next billion they're getting chucked off really quick.
Wow. Now, that curve has got to be obviously expected to slow down at some point, but do we expect to hit all 6.7 billion or some number greater than the number of people on Earth first, or where does it look like that's going?
It could definitely go higher than the world population, again, with this multiple phone thing, where certain people could have more than one phone, you know, kind of like the whole Swatch watch thing, where someone's got, you know, just a bunch of watches. So it could go higher. So you could have people who don't have them, like people in Africa might continue to not have them, and then you could have, you know, 10 billion mobile phones like that, just because some people just have three or four for some reason. Although you seem to be less reason for that, but yeah.
So would you say, if we're to look at these two facts, the idea that people have achieved a, you know, localized middle class standard of living, that they've worked their way out of poverty, half the population of the world has, and the fact that half the population of the world now has a mobile phone. What's the relationship between those two? Is it cause and effect? If so, what's causing what? Or are they just an interesting correlation and something else lies behind all of it?
I think the mobile phone aspect and the way it correlates to that is that the mobile phone's gotten so cheap. Like when it first came out, it was you had these, you know, only the doctors had them. You had the big brick and it cost, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, maybe more than the car that was in or something like that. So you had that high cost. So then not only was it the availability low because the production was low, but also just the cost. Like even some relatively wealthy person in the developed world wouldn't have it just because it was, I'm not going to spend a car on a mobile phone. I'd buy the car instead. So as the costs have come down, like your PCS mobile, you know, you have these really inexpensive options. I think, and also the whole throwaway, you know, lack of, don't need a credit, don't need a monthly payment thing kind of situation, where the costs have come down. So you have these two kind of crossing lines in that, one, people are getting wealthier, and then two, the cost of certain things like mobile phones, laptops, $100 laptop kind of thing, are coming way down. So that it's so easy to get really cheap electronics, cheaper and cheaper. So that even if people didn't get richer, if they had a few bucks, they can buy either a mobile phone or a data stick or something. So the electronics become so cheap that you know, can buy a candy bar, I could buy some electronics, something like that.
You know, whether it's cause or effect, Brian, it seems that, you know, if half the world has cell phones now, that has to increase the world's efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
In doing everything, basically.
Right, right. So instead of lining up to use the town phone, the one landline or something like that, or a single payphone or something like that, the communication being in contact becomes easier, or the whole aspect of long distance going way down, being able to Skype out or do something, where before, even in the developed world, you were always rationed, oh, I got to have this really short call with someone far away, and trying to keep that down, but now because it's virtually free or you pay a fixed cost and use as much as you want, that you don't have to worry about it anymore. Just certain electronics, certain communications, certain technology things are just becoming like electricity out of a socket. It still has a cost,
you know,
but very low. Go ahead.
As I look at those statistics, it makes me wonder about other things, and I'm not asking you these questions, but I'd like to see these statistics, because Stephen, you know, one of the factoids that we throw around frequently whenever we get on the subject of economics is that it is at least said, and I've seen the numbers, but it's said that more people have been lifted out of poverty in the last 20 years than in all of human history leading up to that time, and this would seem to go along with that pretty well. If suddenly you're looking at half not poor anymore, because I think poverty is kind of the original human condition. If you went back 100 years, you'd see a much bigger percentage, obviously, of poor people in the world. You take it back 500 years, and like everybody's poor except for just a very few people.
Even the rich people lived pretty Spartan lives by comparison to ours. You know, I wouldn't trade places with a king in the Middle Ages right now at all. No way. You know?
Yeah, we've talked about that. You know, I mean, no dental care, right? No medical care. Food choice is not as good as ours. Probably less comfortable bed than we sleep in. Now, what the king had going for him? Okay, it's not like he didn't have anything going for him.
Oh, he had. Yeah, he certainly better than the those below him, but. You know, still.
Yeah, and he had things going for him that we don't have going for us today. For example, I can't raise an army and go invade France. I want to, right? But he had that going for him. But on balance, I don't want to do that. And yeah, you know, I feel like I'm much happier podcast here.
But the thing is, the pharaoh or whatever would need to get, you know, his 1,000 slaves to move the big multi-ton block, and then you can go rent a forklift. And then still do it yourself and still have the power just because you're burning the oil.
Right. Yeah, except I can't really invade France. That's my point.
That might not be that high a bar.
Yeah, actually, I suppose I could. I just don't think it would be a very good idea. Yeah, really, really have no motivation to do that. Now, where I was going with that before I digressed a bit was the other statistics that I'd really like to see would be how many people over that, say, 20 years who didn't have electricity now have electricity, who didn't have plumbing now have plumbing, right? A lot of things that would go along with this just are that you would expect that would go along with this move from poverty into something that we can recognize as approaching middle class. Although, if you look at just the if you look at just the cell phone statistic, it's not necessarily that cut and dry. You can have a cell phone and not have electricity in your house, right? You might have to go to your neighbors to charge it or something like that. There are a lot of people who, there are people who have the one place in the village that has the internet connection to get online. There's probably people who go to the one place they can to recharge the battery on their cell phone, even though they own the phone. They might not own the infrastructure yet. So. Do you think that is economics, I guess, is it possible that the well-being of people, economically speaking, is outpacing the infrastructure, or do you think the infrastructure must be coming along if people are actually better off?
Well, the thing is, because I know that most of the people with the poverty are in China and India, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the 1.3 billion people in China, and say 600 million of them kind of move from poor up to this local middle class kind of situation, and similarly for India, and probably other places in Asia as well is probably where it's mostly happening. Although some places, some in South America and that kind of thing, that's where the bulk of them are. China is and has been building out its power and infrastructure rapidly. You know, like 18 gigawatts from the Three Gorges Dam, knocking out a coal plant every week or something like that. Also now building more nuclear power plants. So their power has gone up like 3 or 4 times. So people definitely were getting more infrastructure in China. I think India's infrastructure is behind. They are building up more stuff, and it has improved some, but I think they're still not to the level of China's infrastructure. So I think some places are getting it, and that's mainly in China, and then India probably over the next 10, 20 years will get some more infrastructure. They're building out, six breeder reactor plants and then more nuclear power plants, and doing a bunch of other stuff to build up the infrastructure. But that's still about 20 years away from something pretty good.
I'll tell you, the reason I asked that one is something that Michael has pointed out a few times in the past to me. Is that at least using some numbers from at some point a while back, there was this interesting phenomenon in the world where there were a certain number of people who were living basically in starvation, and that number doesn't seem to change all that much. And I wonder if that could still be the case even as we see people lifted out of poverty, because people are becoming middle class, is it still possible that there's this, as you work your way down that scale, unfortunately, there's this sharp drop-off, and there are still a lot of people. Well, I mean, it's not a huge proportion of the population, but it's way too many people who are living in starvation. I don't know if you've seen any facts that would back that up or that would contest that one way or the other.
I know they are impacting that. Like China had lifted a lot of people out of hunger and starvation. I think, you know, like a couple hundred million people have been, you know, 200, 300 million people have lifted out of starvation in China. And a lot more people in China, like they are eating more meat and you know, the calories are increasing, you know, such that, you know, probably they even have a bit of that overweight problem starting to happen. So various places in Asia definitely are, you know, the amount of nutrition, amount of food and stuff that they have is improving. So definitely there are still people who are starving and there's, in Asia still, even in China, but in Africa in particular, but I think the situation is improving. Definitely if, you know, as you project forward on China getting to, say, you know, $10,000 per year per person or $20,000 per year per person in the 2015-2020 time frame. Actually, probably not 20,000, but it depends on what's happening with the currency. But definitely getting up to the level of Malaysia to South Korea or something like that, you know, they will have broadly hit the starvation thing. And also they're going to go from to quite a high level of urbanization as well. So they'll definitely, I think, resolve a lot of those issues and move from anywhere close to a borderline thing up to a fairly developed state. And then India is about, I think, 20 years behind. You know, they're improving. I think they're about to about $2,000 per person now or something like that, or 1,800. So they're about, I think, maybe half what China has per person like that. The fact that those two countries, those huge populations are moving out up to a higher level is really, I think there's kind of like two-thirds of the people who are moving out of, up into the middle class are from China and India. And then the other places like Vietnam and other places that are also doing pretty well.
How about Africa? Have we seen much movement there?
I have not heard of anything particularly that good coming. If it is, it's just like a country here or there. I haven't really heard of any broad movement there that's where things are really working out. Have you guys heard anything?
I hadn't. That's why I asked.
Yeah. No, I haven't either. Yeah, that would be very encouraging to hear something. I mean, this is a very encouraging set of stats. But yeah, we want to see. The thing is, once you get a half of humanity out of poverty, you kind of start going, well, now how do we get the rest of humanity out of poverty? Right. That's kind
right.
Of
right.
The question that it raises. Do you have a thought as to if it took us all of human history to get half of humanity out? I mean, this is kind of, you know, it's not
so
really been heralded as big a development as it was. How long now is it going to take to, you know, and is this the old algae covering the pond, right? It takes 30 days for it to cover half the pond, and then on the 31st day it's covered, or do we have years and years and years to go?
Well, I think China may have moved really over the last 40 years, 30 years, something like that. You know, when Deng Xiaoping kind of said, okay, let's stop the stuff that Mao was doing and screwing stuff up and changing. Well, even before Mao, basically China was off the tracks for about 200 years. Like before that, they were fine relatively to everyone else, but then, you know, for 200, 300 years, they were like really screwed up. And they pretty much started their decline from above once they burned all their boats. Back in, I think, 1600, something like that. So basically, it was stop screwing up and start picking stuff up from about 35, 40 years ago. So, other countries, you know, India basically, you know, stopped the India growth rate thing and started doing some stuff, pick itself up, you know, probably about like 20-some years ago. So the countries can move up fast. It's just a matter of enough people within the country at the top in particular to decide, you know, I really get less into my Swiss bank account by just stealing from poor people. If I was to make them all rich, you know, then I would even get even more if I'm still near the top. So if they're just willing to have a little bit of farsightedness on this thing, that it's okay if other people get rich, I'll still get rich too, then a lot of things can improve. I think they really need to, you know, open up to, well, just follow the pattern that the other countries follow. Like China followed what Taiwan and South Korea did, and they followed what Japan did. And so it's the model's out there for a country to turn itself around. It just has to, you know, follow the expert model, open itself up to the global companies that come in and advise and build things up. And I think the global companies realize that, you know, we don't want to rip off poor people. We just want to come fix things up, and then as they raise up, we have customers. So I think the system's there. Just a matter of certain places being willing to follow along. And it can happen pretty quick. You know, Vietnam's picked up pretty quick, and other places are picking up pretty quick. And anyone who's willing to follow this now, I think, fairly proven model can get their country turned around.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're close to close to the end of your available time this evening. Brian, do you have time for one more question, or should we let you go?
Another question. I also have a comment if the question's not on that thing I was going to comment on.
Oh, okay, sure. Just my last question would be, and I'm following your reading. I think it makes an awful lot of sense that there were these economies where they open up, where they adopt a certain level of transparency. They're accepting of kind of participation in a global economy, and then there's a certain ethical component both inside the country for their own officials and outside for the people coming in doing business with them. But what about just generally? Is there anything that people like us, you know, I'm not really involved in this in an official way, but is there something people could be doing to make a bigger difference than maybe what people are doing somehow be a part of this?
If a country's really corrupt and messed up, I actually tried to do some things with in the Philippines back in the mid-90s and stuff like that, and basically that was too early. I think they're trying to clean some stuff up now. But basically, back then, one thing they're really corrupt, unless you have a staying power of a large company and the ability to resist the corruption and payoffs or still do business properly with it, an individual going in there just kind of gets, you know, it's the reason it's so tough to move things, you know, pre-cleaning up corruption, because that corruption thing is just this bottomless pit. You know, it's just like, you know, you see it here, you know, even with, you know, your Blagojevich or whatever his name was over in Illinois, or you know, there's certain things where the pocket, you know, the pocket is just, you know, if the hole in the pocket, no matter what you dump in there, just goes away. So unless you're big enough to you know, prevent that stuff from happening, even if you are, sometimes that can still be lost. That until they decide to drain their own swamp, whatever individuals do just tend to get lost. At that point, you're just looking at aid and comfort to, you know, at the individual level, more for, you know, the aid thing. But that doesn't change the direction of the country. Unless you're some miracle Mother Teresa type person who can really pull something off, and even then you're really fighting against the current to make something happen there. And I think
I'm not. I mean, Stephen kind of is like that, but
yeah.
I'm not really one.
We've actually brought that up, Brian, in the past, where sometimes the problem with sending aid, even or charity, to these regions is that it doesn't often get to the people that need
it. One thing I will comment up on, kind of related to that, and related to something else I want to make, was that where technology and where certain other things can make a difference is that I think that there was recent talk about hydrophobic sand, where a company has, I think it was a European developed technology that's picked up by a Middle Eastern company, where basically they have waterproof sand and they can use it to reduce the amount of irrigation needed to do by about four times. So 75% less water is wasted because they stick it in plastic and have it about like 4 inches or 10 centimeters thick, and you put about like say 5-6 feet down, and so it prevents the water from draining out, because you have such a low water table there that the water, just if you put into it, just keeps draining down. So if you have this kind of artificial water table there, then you can help green the desert four times easier because you're using less water. So then that also changed the whole dynamic of the poverty cycle, because if I can get more desert green, like if UAE goes from 3% green to 8% to 15%, then all the poor people there can then work the land and can do a certain level of farming and stuff like that, and start bringing themselves out of poverty. Plus, food becomes cheaper. All sorts of positive feedback cycles happen. So that there is a role for certain technology things, and your Dean Kamen types who can get some water purifier, some other things. You know, the basic, you know, water, food, agriculture type stuff. That if you can make that happen, that might be able to be. To take hold and help things along at a certain level in spite of certain aspects of corruption. Like not to the level of corruption or the level of violence where you have some roving machete gang, because, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a farm, they're just come and hack you up anyway, but to the level of a corrupt bureaucrat, you know, they wouldn't necessarily screw up your more productive farm or the fact you have clean water. You know, they just want a payoff separate. So if you have at least, you know, some roving gang, tribal, ethnic violence thing, you can at least help in the event of improved health, improved water access, and various other things, which could provide a base level where, you know, the really poor people not just are poor, they're also sick and besides sick and starving, they have all the other issues. So if you at least have them healthy, having a problem getting clean water and having a basic level of food, then that becomes the equivalent probably of, like, you know, $400, $800 a year type person, someone just at a step below middle class, as opposed to the $100 per year person who's just, like, not just poor, but, you know, starving and sick and all this stuff. So
right.
That's a shift.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, ultimately, it's. I mean, the technology is going to drive it, but there has to be this level of this ethical component to it. And it's interesting because it gets down to the point where it's not that government officials aren't going to be corrupt in certain countries. There's parts of the world, maybe in the whole world. I don't know. I don't mean to point anyone out more than anyone else, but there are definitely places where the governments are fairly corrupt, and yet. It works, right? You know,
right.
I mean, you're where you're not looting the populace to the point where absolutely nothing can happen. So, if they can just get to that baseline, it makes a big difference. I know we're keeping you late. Did you have anything else you wanted to say? You said you had one more comment you wanted to make.
Yeah, well, that was the one. And then in terms of you talked about, you know, 100 years and going back, the difference between, you know, Mexico and the United States is basically like, you know, like 1-2% growth per year for 100 years. So that's the difference. Like, you basically start off at the same point, and yet have this 6 times difference in wealth now. That's the difference. And then if you look at the difference between the United States and Africa, this, you know, 2-3% difference for 200 years. So basically, there's, or even probably just 2%. So there's not a huge, these growth rates per year kind of really drive the whole thing. If you kind of like if we're going to shift to the singularity and go up to 25-30% growth, if you don't get onto the basic bandwagon, then it's a matter of if you don't hop on early enough, that if you decade after decade just sit still, then the other guys take off and then you're just left at the station. So that's the importance of growth, and also of getting everyone on board with it, so that if you don't, then you get left behind and people say, well, why do they have the aid and whatever? Anyway, so that's my last point then.
Yeah, and you can see how a country can make it up really fast the way China has, where they've
right.
had double-digit growth for quite a few years over the last few years, and suddenly they've become this world economic powerhouse. So, hopefully other countries can follow China's model, and we'll see that kind of growth in a lot of places. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being with us. I know we've got past your time. We always enjoy having you on. We look forward to talking with you again. For everyone listening, Brian blogs at nextbigfuture.com. By all means, go over there. Of course, we'll have links, but check out that blog. A lot of great stuff there. Brian, thank you. Thank you once again. We'll look forward to having you on again soon.
Thank you. Great to be here. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Brian. Okay.
All right. Well, we kept it longer than we were supposed to. But I hope we'll get him back nonetheless. That really lays it out in a nice kind of starting point for our discussion here this evening. But before we delve further into this, let me just say this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil and Stephen, we're talking about speculonomics, and we're talking about where economic development might be taking the world, particularly unexpected positive directions that it might be taking us. So I just, you know, I saw this as such a nice breath of fresh air in the face of all the economic gloom and doom that we're seeing. And then when I read Josh Hall's article, which did Brian refer to that now, or did he talk about it before the show started? I can't remember.
I don't think he referred to it on the show.
Okay, so we'll provide a link to that as well. J. Storrs Hall, the new president of Foresight Nanotech, has written a couple of interesting essays over the last couple of weeks on the subject of singularity, and he's examining the singularity from a number of different viewpoints. But one of the most interesting is the economic standpoint, and he talks about an essay that was written by Robin Hanson, the economist Robin Hanson, about 11 years ago, one that we have referenced a few times on The Speculist, in which Hanson lays out the kind of the next big economic shift, which he says we're in the midst of now, but we're not really seeing the rate of growth that it's going to cause. Of course, the three big shifts would be moving humanity gatherer population to an agrarian culture, and then from agrarian to industrial, and now from industrial to information. And by his calculations, and the papers go through it in fairly exquisite detail, but his calculations, within the next 100 years or so, or 89 years now, if his prediction holds true, we would see a leap of productivity, a leap of economic growth, unlike anything that the world has encountered before. And we would live in a world where the worldwide economy would double in size every month, possibly as fast as every 2 weeks, which just sounds like an absolute out-and-out fantasy. It doesn't sound like something that a serious economist would say. But if you follow the numbers, if you do the math along with them, if you follow the projections, it actually makes a certain kind of sense. And that was something that we hadn't looked at or talked about in quite some time, and I was pleased to see Josh writing on that subject, kind of reminding us about that different sort of outlook on our economic future. And he took it down a notch, which I thought was kind of interesting. For one thing, he corrects the time frame, and he gives us somewhere between 2020 and 2030. And he says, no, we're not going to see an economy that doubles every 2 weeks. He gives us the mere, we'll have an economy that grows at about a rate of 70% to 100% per year. Okay, so we'll have the world economy doubling, kind of along Moore's Law, basically, right? It's going to double every, call it every 2 years, right? Let's be real conservative and say it's going to double every 2 years. Now,
I thought was absolutely fascinating about that, Phil, was that the way he put it, he says there's a technology that precedes the boom. Okay, he says it's like a kaboom, and with agriculture, it was proto-riding and riding that preceded, people getting together in groups, and then the agricultural boom, and then with the Industrial Revolution, the ka was the printing press, and then the boom, of course, was when the advances of the mental advance that caused by the printing press was made physical in the Industrial Revolution. Now, I suppose the car will be computers and information technology bringing about a boom singularity within a few years.
I think so. I think, maybe the the ka is the computer technology. Maybe the boom comes when that starts being applied to the production of physical goods, which is kind of what we've hit on a few times over the last few weeks talking about this. If people are producing their own stuff using electronics technology, programmable matter, right? That's the end game, the fab labs, the replicators. Then you start to think, well, maybe the economy really could move at those kinds of clips, because the barriers to production and just in time delivery and all that kind of thing, it seems like that all gets eliminated and everything's happening at kind of a micro scale, but at an unbelievably fast pace. And I think actually, if we swing it back to our current era, you can see how rapidly things happen now compared to how rapidly they did even a few years ago, or even with, you know, especially if you were to compare the world that we live in now with the world that we grew up in when we were kids, the speed at which things happen. And actually, Stephen, I have kind of an interesting audio example of that.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, let me set this up just a little bit. Cell phones are not just something that we use just for a status symbol or anything. They're actually an incredibly useful tool. And I saw this commercial, it might have been a Super Bowl commercial, but it was basically asking the question, what if delivery people ran the world? And of course, you know, delivery people, they use cell phones, and in this particular example, they were using BlackBerries to keep track of basically packages. And these particular delivery people, they were running a school. So let me play this.
All right, class, let's button it. Becker.
Here.
Callahan. Delivery confirmation on Callahan.
Drop them off at 8:15.
Gymnasium.
No, sir, no Callahan.
Always.
No Callahan. Just a freshman.
Thank you.
No emails from his parents. Drivers, I need a 20 on Callahan. Got him. Reroute him straight to detention.
Get more done now with a new BlackBerry Curve, the only BlackBerry Curve with Nextel Direct Connect.
Okay.
Anyway. I love the route him straight to detention.
And all this happens within seconds. Yeah. The poor kid who's trying to skip out on class, he's got no chance. I mean, the system is just too good. You know?
The system is, yeah, we point out those BlackBerries were being used as walkie-talkies.
Yeah, exactly.
You can just picture a big warehouse or like a UPS or someplace like that where they're moving a lot of stuff through and they're actually able to track things in real time. Yeah, the kid's got no chance. I'm trying to skip out. I love the bit where she says, "No Callahan, no Callahan," and that's a kid who's been stuck in his own locker, right?
Yeah, just a freshman. The kid says, "Thanks."
Thank you.
That was awesome.
That's awesome.
It's humorous, but it makes a very important point. I mean, the world works a little bit different. I mean, you know, imagine UPS circa 1970. You know, it was not the same outfit it is today.
Not at all. Not at all. The idea that, well, I don't think, say 1970, there was no such thing as overnight, right?
Yeah.
Was FedEx around then? I don't think there was. Certainly, the idea that you could go online, there was no online, and track the progress of your package. Now I go nuts if I can, you know, if I'm really expecting something, if I can't go online and go, well, okay, so it was in Inglewood and it arrived there, and now they say the driver's out with it. You know, you're on the phone talking to people, and they say, well, they'll tell you what street the driver is on now, and that kind of thing. The ability to track what's happening, and yeah, the speed at which the transactions conclude today, compared with where that was 30 years ago. Yeah, now take that and push it 30 years into the future, and what does the world look like? It starts to get pretty hard to imagine, I think.
Well, now, you know, half the world now has cell phones, and I think that's a pretty big deal. You know, I think maybe, you know, we were saying, is it chicken or egg? Is it the cell phone that's lifting people out of poverty, or is it – it may be that, you know, once you get past a certain point where you're not worried about where your very next meal is coming from, you have the opportunity to do so many other things that can continue to improve your situation. One of them may be just to pick up a cell phone and plug in and you know, become part of the system and have the system work in your favor.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that if we'd had some more time to talk with Brian, that he did about was just how big of a difference cheap technology can make.
Yeah.
And obviously there's been this just downward spiral in terms of the price of mobile phone technology that would enable half of the world now to have one. And he lists the $100 laptop, and he talks about the cheap cell phone, and then also that you're going to need effective medical care and public health and prevention. So that, you know, that's where all the infrastructure really starts to become an issue, especially when you start adding clean water, that people have enough food, that they have clean air. You know, when all of that is supported by technology that is readily available, when that technology is in place and it's ensuring that those things happen, you start to think, yeah, maybe we really can picture lifting the rest of the world out of poverty in a fairly short period of time.
Yeah. You know, in the book The Singularity Is Near, Kurzweil talked about like an exponential growth in technology and of course, a corresponding, I guess, economic boom that follows each. But he looked at it as sort of a smooth curve. Hansen and then Josh Hall also looked at it as like one series of technology, you know, advancing us as far as it could before handing off to another technology.
Yeah, what they're showing in economics looks a lot like the series of S curves that Kurzweil shows for technologies.
Right.
Only it's a much longer time scale, and there's fewer points on the graph. But I think if you were to plot it out that way, that's what it would look like. And yeah, I think I find it very encouraging to be reminded of these facts. I was really glad to come upon Josh's article the same week that I read the piece that Brian had put up in light of all of the news that we're currently getting about the economy. And I think one of the things that you keep hearing is that we're getting ourselves in a lot of trouble with the way the economy is going right now, with the government spending so much money. You know, are we laying this burden of debt on our children and our grandchildren that they'll never be able to repay? And this is, you know, this is obviously a concern that people have.
I think it's a legitimate concern. Based on what we see now, I mean, it sure is a lot of money. You know, and I think it's a legitimate concern. But if what we're seeing is anywhere close to being right, then we'll be able to pay it off. So it's, you know, I see it as a legitimate concern, but one that maybe we might be worrying a little bit too much about.
Well, it's not that you're not going to hear me say, so we should just borrow as much money as we want to. Or that we shouldn't worry about borrowing money, or that we shouldn't worry about what the world's going to be like for us. Obviously, we want to be concerned about all those things. But I'm to the point now where I think, well, when I hear that, am I really hearing concern for the children and the future? And I'm sure with a lot of individuals that is in fact what you're hearing. Or am I hearing the argument that you have to make when you're not the party in power? Because I take it all the way back to the 80s when Reagan was in office, and that's when I first heard about the deficit. We've got this killer deficit. We're laying this burden of debt on our grandchildren. We'll never be able to dig our way out of this, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, 10 years later, when Clinton was in office, we had a budget surplus. Right, it was all gone. Everything was okay. You know, there's still the fear of impending Medicare and Social Security, and those remain big fears today. But that hole, we've dug a hole that we can't possibly get ourselves out of, turned out, you know, not to be true. Even a decade later, it seemed like just with economic growth that seemed fairly predictable, seemed fairly plannable, and something that we might have been able to anticipate. Now, when you say we're not talking about the fairly anticipatable growth curve, but we're talking about things going outrageously in our favor, we can't count on that happening, but supposing for a moment that that is actually what's going to happen, then yeah, the whole issue of we're laying this huge burden on our children and our grandchildren, it just seems to become kind of a non-starter. It's like, no, probably we're not. We're probably not being as responsible as we should, and we might be slowing down how fast we get to prosperity, but we're probably not doing anything with the imagined long-term consequences.
This is what we call bipartisanship here at the Speculist. Last week, we compared the government to the loud, obnoxious person who crashes your party. And this week, we're reassuring everybody that we'll probably be able to pay off this debt.
To me, it's not a political thing. I observed that that 6 months ago, Democrats were telling me, oh Lord, we've got this huge budget deficit issue and it's going to kill us. And today, it's Republicans saying, oh no, we're spinning ourselves into, you know, and not to say that those aren't legitimate concerns both times they're raised, but it's interesting that it flips who's talking about it, you know. Anyway, we've got a question from the chat room. Will Brown wants to know whether we're focused too much on technological development instead of technical desire, that is R&D status and guys we hope are in their garage hard at work versus the consumer wish list. That's an interesting question.
Well, my thought is that, no, I mean, and the reason I don't think so is because if technology is developed, we always find uses for it. We always will find a desire for it once we see what the new tech can deliver to us. We'll find that we couldn't live without it, after it's developed. If I understand the question right.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure I read that right. Michael, can you clarify? Did I characterize what Will was asking correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually paraphrased it in order to put it into text. The way Will wrote it was, are we looking too closely at tech development instead of asking the user or the market how he or she wants to use the new or coming technological advances? But I think you captured the spirit of it in the question, which is, you know, are we thinking about all the what for us is gee whiz, wouldn't it be cool if what technology might or might not be able to do, and overlooking what people will actually pay for? To which, you know, I responded, hey, post singularity, isn't everything supposed to be free?
Right. Well, post singularity, everything is supposed to be free, or you pay for it in something other than money. You pay for it in reputation or something like that. We have that completely different economy showing up. But yes, yeah, stuff is actually free at that point. So, taking that idea, because speaking of what you do with it, let's go back to the idea of some basic fabrication technology. I really got thinking about this earlier today. I was running the idea of how do we lift the rest of the world out of poverty around in my head. This is a great kind of question to think about as you're grocery shopping and doing other errands. You know, I highly recommend to people that you spend time thinking about these issues. And the thing I came up with was, if you've got people up to the up to the local middle class level, as Brian described it, then you've got people who are just below that who are looking for the opportunity to do that. And one of the things that I've heard about and read about are these micro businesses that people are helping organizations, NGOs, and others in the West are helping the developed world, individuals in the developed world, to start these little businesses. And the example I heard, I think it was on like the Hugh Hewitt show, I think he was talking about somewhere in Latin America, I can't remember where it was, these people who live in, you know, what we would consider fairly abject poverty, but they're really kind of getting a handle on their lives because they've got their own little business now. And they're making they have just about enough to go out and buy some hot dogs every day. And then the guy goes out in it's kind of a busy city he lives in. He sells hot dogs, and they're making this little tiny profit, and it's actually become this source of income, and it's you know, it's actually a living for this family. And you think, well, you multiply that story by dozens, hundreds, thousands of stories, and suddenly you see people emerging from poverty with just a little bit of a push that probably, you know, bought the first bag of hot dogs and buns, right? I mean, probably wasn't much more than that needed to get into that point. And I got thinking, well, what about in some of these urban areas? If you had a few of these fabricators, if you just let some people have them and they could start making, you know, it's not the universal fabricator that can make everything, but just a little piece of equipment that could turn plastic bottles. We were hearing about those in Delhi a couple weeks ago. We were talking about that, how they can't get rid of them. They got too many of them. You take plastic bottles and convert them into some little tchotchke that the tourists would buy, right? If you could just give that much capability to a few poor people, suddenly, you know, you've made a radical change in their lives, and probably you've seeded that economy in a really significant way. So what I'd like to see, because we've talked about, you know, having the replication technology so we can make our own cell phones and make our own, flying cars and those kinds of things. But as that technology gets going, even if it's in its really early stages, if there's something usable there, if we could find a way to get that into the hands of the people who are just on the cusp looking for a way out of poverty, it seems like that could make a tremendous difference.
Neil Gershenfeld wrote in his book Fab about experimenting with exactly that sort of thing, Phil. MIT funded a project whereby he went to the developing world and set up a few fab labs and just to see what people from around there would do. He says it was remarkable. I think there's a video or two about those experiences out there on YouTube, and if I can find them, I'll certainly put them in the show notes.
I'd like to see that. I should read that book. That sounds great. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that idea is not original to me, because that means that people more likely than I am are trying to push that into being. That's that just seems like the kind of natural fit. If there's a technology in the world that can start turning the corner for the second half of humanity to pull them out of poverty, it seems like the fabrication technology would be it. And he was talking about people starting businesses using waste materials and that sort of thing. That was the idea?
Exactly. And so he says it was remarkable. And they've just left those fab labs, kept them in operation and just to see what people could do with them and you know, starting businesses and everything else. So, he said he was very excited about, it's a lot different from, just sending food over to people. I mean, you eat the food and it's gone and they're back where they were. But, you know, it's kind of the old adage, teach a person to fish, you know. It's the same thing,
exactly.
Allowing them to join the world economy. And I think you're exactly right. I think that is going to have a profound impact on the world, particularly once the fab technology improves more and more, and it gets cheaper and cheaper. It'll have a big impact, particularly in the developing world.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think we spent nearly as much time on the issue of debt and how big of a threat it really is as we intended, but we can pick that up at some point. But I see we're already getting fairly close to our time. So, Michael, any last words from the chat room on the subject of Speculonomics?
No.
All right.
Fair enough. Stephen, any parting comments on that?
I guess we can. We'll pick it up next week. I think there's more to talk about here.
I think we've probably got more to talk about too, so we'll just keep pushing on. This is becoming an economic show. I tell you what, next week we'll do Speculonomics, and the following week we'll do flying cars or something. So we'll bring it back. Bring it back to some other favorite speculative topics. But all right, well, what have we got on tap for music this evening?
The song is City Streets by 6 Day Slide.
All right. 6 Day Slide singing City Streets. That's a little bit of a tongue twister, but I managed to get that out. Well, Stephen, we look forward to looking at that. Thanks for your contributions to the show this evening. Michael, thanks to you and to our Will, especially in the chat room, for your question. And thanks once again to Brian Wong for being with us. And everyone listening, whether you're listening live or listening to us on MP3, we enjoy being with you every week, and we look forward to being with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Got me in her arms and I'm listening while the